I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Another week, another mass shooting in America. 10 people were killed in Boulder, Colorado on Monday, and officials are still piecing together what happened and why. We will do a program on gun violence once we know more. Today we want to focus on the mass shooting in Georgia just last week, the murder of 8 people at 3 Asian-owned spas. 6 of the victims were women of Asian descent. The organization Stop AAPI Hate, that's a coalition that tracks threats against Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders, reported 3,800 incidents of anti-Asian violence and harassment since last March, most aimed at women, a big increase from the years before. USA Today reported this morning that online hate and harassment against Asian Americans has increased dramatically during the pandemic. Well, here to talk about all of this and what it means and the roots of some of this violence and threat and racism against Asian Americans is Mari Uehara. She's a freelance journalist whose latest piece featured in The Nation is titled The Roots of the Atlantic Shooting, Go Back to the First Law Restricting Immigration. Mari Uehara, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And I should say she joins us by Skype. Also joining us is Jennifer Ho. She is president of the Association of Asian American Studies, also professor of ethnic studies at the University of Colorado in Boulder. And Jennifer Ho, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Glad to be here.
And as I mentioned, I do want to focus on Georgia, but you are in Boulder, Colorado, Jennifer Ho, the site of Monday's shooting. And I'm just wondering how Boulder is doing, how the community is doing, how you are doing, faced with such violence up close.
Thanks for asking me that. I was actually on campus when everything unfolded, which is odd because I hadn't been back to my office in over a year. And there was just such shock, but also not surprising. Yeah. I mean, that's how I felt about both the Atlanta shooting and Boulder, that I thought it was probably just a matter of time before both things happened.
And why do you say that?
Well, in the case of Atlanta, it was only a matter of time that the anti-Asian racism that has been percolating for over a century and that was really erupting during COVID was going to end in violence, and not end in violence, be one in which there was a violent encounter, a mass shooting. And Boulder, I've just expected that at some point I would live in a place in which there was a mass shooting because, sadly, we have a gun culture and a violent culture and a racist, misogynist culture that means that this is an exact recipe for these kinds of mass shootings to happen.
Mari Uehara, that is a toxic brew that Jennifer Ho just described. Your thoughts at this moment?
Yeah, part of my background is my grandparents were interned during World War II. My grandmother actually led the fight for reparations out of Philadelphia to get the 1988 Civil Liberties Act passed, which was an apology, a little bit of money. And I was reading an interview with her recently. She passed. She was talking about how important it was for these Japanese American civil rights leaders to get an educational portion from the government as part of their settlement. And I just found it really heartbreaking and disappointing that we are where we are now when there have been so many activists working so hard for more than 100 years to educate the American public on the danger of racism and the violence and the violation of, you know, all our values that happens when it's allowed to, just continue unabated.
Well, that's in part why you're both here, because we also believe that, you know, we need to understand this history to put today's events into some kind of context and to hopefully move on from here. Jennifer Ho, if I can go back to you, you had a piece in CNN just a couple of days ago where you wrote, to be an Asian woman in America means you can't just be what you are, a fully enfranchised human being. It means you are a blank screen on which others project their stories, especially too often their sexualized fantasies, which is a powerful thing to say. And I want you to expand on that personally.
Yeah. So recently I was on a local NPR show and I was asked to listen in on a piece before me by a Vietnamese American woman. And she shared that at the age of 16, she was first, not only, but first propositioned by a white American man who told her that she looked like the girls he had met in Nam. Hmm. And it brought back a memory I had of being 14 when the same thing happened to me. And I didn't think it was unusual. How could I not think it was unusual at the age of 14 that I was being propositioned by a white veteran to have sex? And yet, I think the reason I didn't think it was unusual was that at the age of 14, in the 1980s, I was already receiving covert and overt messages in popular media that what it meant to exist as an Asian woman in U.S. society was to be sexualized. And certainly as a woman in U.S. society, you have to get used to being sexualized. When you're an Asian American woman, it takes on a much different dimension in terms of the U.S. military and the centuries of equating Asian women with sex and sex work.
And I want to pick up on that. Let me go back to you, Mari. Do you have a similar experience to Jennifer?
Yeah, I mean, it was funny that all this kind of brought up. It wasn't quite as explicit, but, you know, when I was younger, I was very into soccer, played year-round. I grew up in Massachusetts. There was a tournament in Connecticut. At the time, you know, players coming from out of state were staying with other families in that state. And so I must have been like cusp of teenage years. And I remember the, you know, father of the household where I was saying to me, oh, I think Asian women are the most beautiful women in the world. And, you know, I didn't quite have an understanding of the context of all that. And I remember going back home and repeating this to my mother and her face just kind of screwing and just anger and disgust. And, you know, now that I look at that as a much older woman, it's just amazing to think that a male, you know, adult would think that that was an appropriate thing to say to a guest in his house who was young in front of his family. I mean, the acceptance of these kinds of attitudes over years is appalling.
Let me go back to you, Jennifer. And as I mentioned, you're both here to help us understand some of this history. But what you both are saying reminds me a bit of what the shooter said or allegedly said in Georgia about, you know, frequenting these spas, feeling that he had some kind of sex addiction, and then, of course, goes and kills eight people. Does that sort of feed into the stereotype that we're talking about, Jennifer Ho?
Absolutely. And it began, and I read Mari's piece and I admired it so much because I think she did a great job in showing just how it began with the first entrance of Chinese immigrant women into the United States and then the first codification of immigration restriction, which was because Asian women, specifically Chinese women, were assumed to be prostitutes and assumed to be diseased. And so our understandings of who Asian women in America are from the moment they first hit shore was that they're prostitutes, they're diseased, they are thus not quite human. And I think combined with the fact that in American society in general, we don't treat sex workers of any racial or ethnic background with a whole lot of respect and dignity, the fact that to be an Asian woman in America means that you're automatically sexualized and associated with sex work really furthers that dehumanization.
And to you, Mari, picking up what Jennifer said there and going back to your piece, women largely, I guess, from China brought to the United States, in many ways brought as sex slaves for, I guess, what, workers in the western part of the country?
Yes, some were and some weren't. And, to be clear, during the Gold Rush, women of all nationalities worked as sex workers in these kind of communities. And that was not atypical. That happened anytime people were setting up that kind of work. But Chinese women in particular were targeted. And I think it's important to note that there was a sort of geopolitical and domestic purpose in tagging Chinese women as sex workers and other women as kind of, having individuality. And that was to keep Chinese migrants out of this country. The politicians and white labor groups in particular on the West Coast for decades were trying to pass laws to keep out Chinese immigrants. And to get a law passed, they needed to kind of elevate the stereotype about Chinese women to bar them from immigrating. And they admitted the purpose of that was to keep Chinese men from marrying and settling in communities. So from the beginning, there was really a political purpose in keeping California white. And when I say keep California white, that was actually a slogan of one of the senators, James Phelan. And so this was a predominant political motivator on the West Coast at the time was anti-Chinese activism, and so there was a purpose behind painting Chinese women as sex workers, and that's continued on into these imperial wars we have, this continued dehumanization of non-white people in general and women in particular as sex workers has, helped us feel better about how we treat countries abroad as well.
We're almost having a break here, but Jennifer Ho, what that reminds me of is our sort of overall approach to immigration, which is that we sort of on the one hand deny immigrants, and then we also need immigrants at the same time.
Absolutely. I mean, we need only look at the southern border to understand the ways in which the United States has really welcomed Latinx laborers, Latin American laborers into the United States, and at the same time use a rhetoric that we must expel them. And in doing so, we dehumanize them.
Well, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Jennifer Ho. She is president of the Association for Asian American Studies, also a professor of ethnic studies at the University of Colorado at Boulder. Mari Uehara is a freelance journalist, and they both join us today on Radio Times. We're talking about what happened just a couple of days ago, last week in Georgia, what that tells us about the threats against Asian Americans, especially Asian American women of Asian descent. Much more after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. Just a recap, in light of the spa shootings last week and the increase in attacks during the pandemic, we're taking a look at the roots of violence and discrimination against people of Asian descent in this country and what can be done to address the problem. And you can join us, Radio Times, at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Jennifer Ho, I'm kind of toggling back and forth between some of our history and also where things stand today, but I just wanted to focus a bit on the pandemic. We're celebrating about acknowledging about a year of living under the pandemic. And as we know, President Trump would talk about the Chinese virus or Kung flu. How much do you think that that has exacerbated some of the threats and violence that the people of Asian American descent have been feeling?
Well, while I don't think that I can necessarily link to exact causality, I certainly don't think it helped. Any time that anyone of such prominence, who has such a large megaphone and platform, is demonstrating that it is totally fine to be openly saying racist things, is not a good thing. And there has been a study that it showed that after Mike Pompeo, you blamed China and also used the phrase China virus, that there was an uptick immediately following the next day on reports of anti-Asian harassment. It just doesn't help to have people dehumanize others. And anytime that happens, you think, oh, then it's totally fine for me to just say and do racist things because the President of the United States is similarly saying incredibly racist things.
Is it different now under a new administration? It's only been a couple of months, but nonetheless.
I mean, it feels different to me. I watched Kamala Harris on television, and the fact that you have someone who looks like Kamala Harris, who's had her experiences growing up as a woman of color, as a mixed race, black South Asian woman, and the way that she's able to speak, not just from her professional experience, but from her lived experiences, I mean, that makes an incredibly huge difference to me. Someone on Facebook posted about a Washington Post writer who said that, you know, Kamala Harris was someone who had experiences that were just like her. So in other words, just her even being a woman, the fact that I think she knows what it's like to have to deal with sexual harassment, to have to deal with a stranger coming up to you and talking to you, and you just want to go about your day, and you're worried that if you brush him off or you're rude, that you might get hurt. And I think a lot of men don't know what that's like.
Well, let me go back to you, Amari Wehar, and picking up on what Jennifer Ho just said there, and looking at some of the studies about the increase in threats and violence and harassment, it seems to be more majority aimed at women versus men. Does that make sense to you? And what does that tell us?
Yeah, I mean, it's also hard to say because, you know, we don't know if maybe in the reporting that maybe women feel more comfortable reporting being harassed than men do. But, you know, historically, as I touched on in this piece, was that in times of plague, we have reactivated these very old ideas of Asian people being dirty and diseased and bringing, you know, plague to this country. And, you know, Asian women in particular are associated with that. So I'm not surprised that there's kind of this miasma of disease, sexuality, and danger that has, you know, kind of materialized in more harassment against Asian women who might be seen as easier targets.
All right, let me go back to your piece, and even going back to the Page Act of 1875, the Chinese Exclusion Act of, I think it's 1882. How does that kind of set the stage for what it is we're talking about now?
Right. So the Page Act of 1875, that was basically to get around this treaty, the Burlingame-Seward Treaty of 1868, which so Lincoln had sent this former rep from Massachusetts, Burlingame, who is an abolitionist, to China as his representative. And when Burlingame got there, he kind of saw that China was being treated very unfairly by Western powers and taken advantage of in various treaties. So he tried to get a more equal treaty. And that treaty said that, you know, there could be free immigration between the countries, between, you know, free people. So to get around this treaty that was in place, Page crafted this federal bill, he said was to end the danger of, quote, cheap Chinese labor and immoral Chinese women. There was an idea at the time that the Chinese laborers who were coming over to America were indentured servants, which they were not. And kind of the corollary was that Chinese women were working in these sort of trafficked slavish professions of sex workers. And what ended up happening is because the Chinese laborers were traveling of their own free will, is that the men didn't get barred from this country, but essentially all the women were, because of the way in which this act was crafted. And basically it meant that you had to prove that you were not a prostitute to immigrate into this country if you were a Chinese woman. And so how do you do that? So, you know, women who are trying to immigrate, who, you know, working class women who didn't have a lot of money, you know, would have to pay for lawyers, which they obviously couldn't do. And they'd have to certify and be subjected to, you know, questioning by these white male consuls about how they were not a prostitute. I mean, just think about it. Having to, you know, trying to immigrate like any other person who immigrated in the 1800s and having to sit there and tell someone you're not a prostitute. It's insane. So, yeah, I mean, these attitudes go back to the 1800s, and it's not just that they existed then, it's that we then continue to promote and legitimize them through legal means, and they hardened within this country. And I think they've been passed down from great grandparents to grandparents, to parents to children, in media, in portrayals of media, and, you know, and kind of upper structures around the country.
Jennifer, Jennifer, if you don't mind, let me get Jennifer Ho back in on the conversation. And just one thing that I wanted to pick up on the PAGE Act, that it apparently forbids citizenship to a Chinese person who married a white American citizen. Do I have that right, Jennifer?
I think that's the Cable Act.
Oh, the Cable Act. Okay. But nonetheless, true?
No, it's terrible. I mean, I would joke with my students in the past that the Cable Act was my favorite racist act that the United States passed, because it was actually penalizing women along with men. So the Cable Act essentially said that if you are someone who marries an alien ineligible for citizenship, and I think this is a really important point to stress about the way that the United States government has dealt with issues of race, which is to say, you don't have to mention specific countries, although the Chinese Exclusion Act is one in which they do.
Sure.
You simply have to exclude the people by a certain category and make sure that only people of Chinese descent or Asian descent are in that category. So the Cable Act basically said any woman marrying a man ineligible for citizenship had her citizenship stripped. So it basically ensured that white American women who fell in love and wanted to marry a Chinese man would not be able to do so without risking loss of citizenship.
Wow. Just let that sink in for a while. Let me just quickly reintroduce our guest. That's Jennifer Ho. She's the president of the Association for Asian American Studies, also a professor of ethnic studies at the University of Colorado in Boulder. Mari Uehara is a freelance journalist, and we saw her piece in The Nation, a story titled The Roots of the Atlantic Shooting Go Back to the First Law Restricting Immigration. And we invited them both to join us on Radio Times to help us understand the roots of some of this violence and discrimination against people of Asian descent and what we can do to address this problem. You can join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Mari, I don't know whether we've been focusing largely on women for, I think, a number of obvious reasons, but I'm wondering about the stereotypes of Asian men that seem to be both pernicious but also long-standing.
Right. You know, and I think a lot of that also goes back to this threat to white male workers on the West Coast and this attempt to shape the nation's identity as white, Christian, and male. So a lot of, you know, popular media tried to vilify Chinese men, as well as, you know, they were often portrayed as either, it's contradictory, as right. either homosexual or as these kind of predators of white women. So, you know, a lot of this was throwing anything at the wall to see what could stick about unwanted immigrant mm-hmm. groups. But, you know, so those were some of the issues. I believe before Chinese men started working on the railroad, when they were working in mining camps, they were often sequestered to jobs that were typically women's work. So cooking, gathering firewood, doing the laundry. And what ended up happening is they were thought of as very weak and too small and all this ridiculous stuff. And they weren't brought onto the railroads until white workers kept abandoning railroad work to go chase various new mining opportunities. And then they brought the Chinese workers on, and obviously they could do the construction and worked through some of the most dangerous conditions in this country, getting you know, their encampments taken away by avalanches, blasting through mountains, all that stuff. So there, you know, have been political and kind of social reasons why there are stereotypes about both Asian sure. women and Asian men.
Jennifer Ho, let me ask you about a more current stereotype, and I'm going to repeat what Tom McClintock said. He's a Republican representative from California, and this was at a hearing, I believe it was last week. He said, what should make us all proud as Americans is that Asian Americans have the highest median income of any ethnic group in America, including white Americans. If America was such a hate-filled, discriminatory, racist society filled with animus against Asian Americans, how do you explain the remarkable success of Asian Americans in our country? What's your response to that?
I have so many responses.
I can imagine you do, but go ahead.
Let me start here. The category of Asian American encompasses, and especially if we include Pacific Islander, we're talking about people whose ancestry comes from over 50 nations. So there is very little that actually unites Asians in America, except for the fact that we have become racialized into a group called Asians, and we also are subject to white supremacy in the way that all other non-white groups are subject to white supremacy. And so what his remarks are missing is that if you start to disaggregate the data, one of the things that people will find is that Burmese, Laotian, and Hmong people in particular, in terms of percentage of population, suffer among the lowest socioeconomic status rates. So they have very low literacy rates in English, they have very low high school graduation rates, and they are definitely living, many of them, below the poverty line. They are not model minorities. And if I can just say one more thing about the model minority myth, which is exactly what his remarks are invoking. The model minority myth was a term coined in 1966 by William Peterson, a white sociologist, who was writing a piece for the New York Times magazine, I think, about Japanese Americans, and specifically the way that they had been incarcerated during World War II, and then docilely came out of the camps and became this American success story. And very specifically, he called them a model minority as a way to contrast Black Americans. So he was basically saying, look at these good, passive Japanese people who we put into camps, they can't even speak English, and yet they raise their kids not to cause any trouble, unlike these Black people who are agitating for civil rights. So the term is really being used as a wedge to divide Asian Americans from Black Americans and then subsequently other minority groups. Not as a compliment, but actually, again, as a tool of white supremacy and division.
How do you see it, Mari?
That's absolutely correct. I think, you know, another dimension to that as well is once you start factoring in educational attainment, Asian Americans don't do as well as white Americans with the same amount of education. So, you know, I think in many families, and that includes Black families and people of various Asian descent, but the idea is you have to be twice as good or 10 times as good to, you know, get in the same opportunities as white people. And I think that's certainly true today. And if you look at the management level in, you know, all sorts of companies, Asian Americans are hired at the bottom, but they are not promoted to management, you know, I would say because of some of these pervasive ideas that they are slavish, docile, not leaders, so on and so forth, that they are just workers and bodies and dispensable bodies at that.
Jennifer Ho, we're almost up at a break, but when you two are using those words, I just wince because they're so hurtful and so painful.
Yeah, it's really hard for those of us of Asian descent right now. And I have to tell you, I'm grateful to be on your program because we have been so invisible. And these stories have been out there. I'm an Asian American studies scholar. I've been studying this for well over two decades. This is the first time that I'm seeing such vast national interest. And I hope we don't lose this.
Me neither. Let me just quickly reintroduce you. We're going to take another short break, get back to our conversation. We've got much more to talk about, and we want to hear from you. You've been listening. We want to get your reaction to what we are talking about. And again, our guests are Jennifer Ho, President of the Association of Asian American Studies and Professor of Ethnic Studies at the University of Colorado in Boulder. Mari Uehara is a freelance journalist, and as I mentioned earlier, we saw her piece in The Nation, and one of the reasons we wanted to have her on, it's titled The Roots of the Atlanta Shooting Go Back to the First Law Restricting Immigration. You can join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us, pick up the phone, 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. In Philadelphia, I got too many thoughts in my head all going at the same time. And if you're just joining us, we're talking about last week's horrific killings at three Asian massage parlors in Georgia. Yet another example of the vulnerability that many people of Asian descent have been feeling in America, especially since the start of the pandemic, although it has a deep history. This act of violence is far from new, and we're talking about the long and frankly brutal history of mistreatment, racism, and discrimination against Asians and Asian Americans and what to do about it. Let me get Cookie to join our conversation. And Cookie, go ahead. You are on Radio Times.
Thank you so much. I'm calling, actually, there's so much to react to, but the comment that I believe Professor Jennifer Ho made with regard to the attitude toward Asian women as prostitutes, I'm just wondering if an experience that I had when I became an American citizen about 4 years ago, after having been in the U.S. for a while, by the way, I'm Japanese by birth and was born and raised there. But in any case, during the interview I had for citizenship, I was asked, have you ever been a prostitute?
Wow. And that was now, a Cookie, that was 4 years ago?
About 4 years ago. So I'm talking modern times. And I was just so shocked. But I thought maybe if I acted shocked, they'd think that I was trying to fake an answer and mm-hmm. that I really was a prostitute. So, but in any case, I've never found an explanation for being asked this question.
Well, maybe Jennifer Ho can help, you know, or I think it was actually Mari, I think, who was talking about what, you know, How do you answer a negative, I guess, and be believed? But what are your thoughts, Mari?
I mean, I'm personally shocked. I don't know what to say because I was looking at it from a historical perspective. I mean, we're talking about the 1870s when Chinese women were branded as prostitutes to keep them out of the country and ask those kinds of questions. So I'm less familiar with current immigration practices, but that sounds abhorrent. I don't know how to react to that exactly.
What do you think, Jennifer Ho?
It's abhorrent. The short answer is this is an example of racist misogyny. The longer answer is that it actually probably doesn't surprise me as much. I have a friend, Hong An Trong, who is a wonderful artist and a professor at UNC Chapel Hill. And part of what she's doing right now for an art project is looking at interview questions for naturalization, starting from Angel Island in the late 19th century to our present day. I bet she wouldn't be surprised. It's a really subjective process. And so it doesn't surprise me that Cookie would face this kind of racist misogyny, although I'm so, so sorry. It's horrible.
It is horrible. And Cookie, I really appreciate the call to Radio Times. You can call as well. And again, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to give us your reaction to what we have been talking about. Actually, Jennifer, if you don't mind, I'd like to go back to you only because you mentioned earlier in the hour that, you know, we need to understand our history in order to address it and hopefully deal with it and maybe even move beyond it. We were talking about the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882, the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II. There was the Chinese Massacre of 1817, during which, and I'm quoting, I think it's either the New York Times or the Washington Post, during which 10% of Los Angeles' Chinese population was wiped out. 17 people were slaughtered during that massacre in the largest lynching in U.S. history. This is part of our history. How do we grapple with that?
We don't forget it, and we don't try and ignore it. I think there is a tendency for people to think that if you recognize the uglier aspects of what the U.S. has done to people, that somehow means that you have to feel ashamed and you have to repudiate the United States. I think the most patriotic thing I will ever do in my life is to talk about what the United States truly has in terms of its history, in terms of the way that it was settled on indigenous land and made rich by enslaved labor of people from African descent, and also exploited labor of people from Asia and Latin America. This is just simply our history. It doesn't have to solely define us. Each and every one of us as human beings has done things that we're not proud of, has made mistakes in our life. And if we tried to think of the United States in that same way and to say, okay, this happened, we have to figure out a way to deal with it, to make sure that things like this don't happen again. Although sadly, I think things are going to repeat because I'm going to say a phrase.
Go ahead.
Oak Creek Massacre. My guess is that the vast majority of listeners do not know what the Oak Creek Massacre is. That was when a gunman came into a Sikh temple in Oak Creek, Wisconsin in 2012. And killed people in their place of worship. The fact that we don't say Oak Creek in the same way that we say 9/11, I think really speaks to the way that Asian Americans and Sikh Americans in particular have their stories ignored.
But what you're saying, Jennifer Ho, is that we have to acknowledge our history. And then I guess the question is, and then what? Then what do we do about it?
Yeah, I mean, thank you for this question, because I've been doing a lot of workshops on anti-racism. And the first thing, if people who are listening want to be an anti-racism advocate, the first thing you have to do is know the history of the United States. And that can take a long time, right? There's a know about the history of race and racism in the United States. And then choose to try and do something. So share what you have learned with others. I really appreciate the opportunity to share what I've learned with all of you today. But you do have to do something. And also to be an active bystander. There is an amazing organization called Hollaback that offers free bystander training. For people who can donate to them, that would be wonderful. But everyone should look up Hollaback Bystander Training and try and take a bystander training, because the more of us who speak out when we see and hear instances of racism and discrimination, the more we can try and make this country the one that is predicated and promised on the American dream that has sadly never come to pass.
Picking up on that, Mari, and going back to you, I'm thinking of, you know, the Black Lives Matter protests of last summer. I mean, is there a sort of a similar protest movement that can speak to what it is we've been talking about today?
You know, I think it's a little bit harder because, as Jennifer mentioned, there isn't a single Asian American community or a single Asian American experience, which is not to say that there aren't, there isn't a lot of diversity within the Black community, but that there is a longer history of more shared experiences, the Black church and so on and so forth there. And so, you know, one of the reasons why we don't have as much of a tradition is that we were kept out for 100 years. Mm. So there just aren't as many Asian Americans in this country. A lot of the Asian Americans who are here today are recent immigrants. And so it does take a while to build those community ties and structures and the language and awareness to, fortify movements of that magnitude.
Let me put this to you, Jennifer Ho. One of our listeners left us a message. He's a Black American, wanted to talk about, and I'm quoting here, about how Asian Americans have never stood for racism against Black Americans before. Now the hate is coming for them. Injustice is everywhere. And that's why we need to stand together to fight it. Picking on this, you know, this is all a very sensitive subject. We're not going to probably do justice to it in the time that we've got left. But can you speak to the relationship between Asian Americans and Black Americans?
I can. First of all, it's not true. And I'm sorry that the listener has this impression. It doesn't surprise me because, again, there has been very little media attention throughout the last decades about all of the ways in which Asian American and African Americans have worked in coalition and solidarity, and specifically two Asian American women, Yuri Kochiyama, a Japanese-American second-generation Nisei who was incarcerated during World War II in Arkansas, and Grace Lee Boggs, a Chinese-American activist married to a Black American man who moved to Detroit and worked alongside him in community organizing. Yuri Kochiyama, most famously, there's a photograph of her in the Audubon Ballroom, cradling Malcolm X's head in her lap. Those are two of the most famous examples within Asian-American history of the way that Asian American women in particular have been working alongside Black Americans for racial justice. There are even more examples on a localized level that I could share. Stories of solidarity between Black and Asian Americans don't get as much attention mm-hmm. as stories of strife.
And picking up on that, as a journalist, Mari, how do you grapple with this?
I think I should talk from personal experience because my grandmother was a civil rights activist in the Philadelphia area, and a lot of the work she did was also with Black Americans. My mother remembers the first protest that she went to was about housing rights for the Black communities in Pennsylvania. And I just want to read, something she wrote to my brother in a book that she gave to him on our history. And it says, "With hope and love that you too will join those who fight injustice of any kind." And it's disappointing to hear that our histories and solidarity is erased in that way, because people have worked very hard to forge those bonds. And separately, we spoke about the model minority myth, but there are a lot of laws that have been built on one another against Asian Americans and against Black Americans that have worked in consort with one another. So some of the early laws that were restricting, say, Chinese immigrants from being able to testify in court, a lot of those were modeled on slave codes. The politicians on the West Coast who were largely anti-Asian would often work with the politicians of the South who were obviously anti-Black to get their various favored prejudice legislation passed. So I think that it's important that we recognize how a lot of these structures got built up.
Mari, before I go to Jennifer, what was your grandmother's name so that we can give her, Google her and give her some more attention, especially here in the Philadelphia area?
Yeah, so my grandmother's name was Grace Uehara, and my grandfather's name was Hiroshi Uehara, and she was the chief lobbyist for the Japanese American Citizens League to get reparations for the Japanese American internment camps where my grandparents actually met.
Where they met. Wow. Jennifer, let me go back to you, and even picking up on what Mari was just saying about some of these restrictions that have, and discrimination, frankly, against African-Americans and Asian-Americans. I'm thinking of some of these marriage restrictions and how, you know, we were talking about that earlier in the hour about how you could, you know, sort of lose your citizenship if you married an Asian-American.
Yeah, I think that I think that the ways in which white supremacy, and I know I'm banging on that drum hard, has really shaped our understandings of who looks like a legitimate American, who is deserving of rights as a fully enfranchised American, can't be understated. And so it's in service to white supremacy that we have stories of division between racial groups. And that's not to say that there haven't been Asian Americans that have anti-Black sentiment. So I want to be really clear. It's not as if just because you're a racial minority in this country, you're automatically in solidarity with one another. There's a lot of misunderstanding. But I definitely think that there are things that, there's things certainly that I, as an Asian American studies scholar in person, owe a debt to Black Americans and specifically Black American civil rights work. Asian American studies would not exist were it not for Black American studies and the work that Black American people did, especially during the civil rights movement. But it is also true that we need advocates and allies of every racial background. So in other words, the Asian American movement owes a debt to Black Americans and others. It would not be here were it not for being able to work coalitionally with a variety of people, including white Americans.
We're almost out of time. And actually, Jennifer, here's a comment from Mary, I think picking up on what you were saying at the very beginning of the hour. Mary says the U.S. military has a role in stereotyping Asian women as sex workers. And you talked about the fact that you would sometimes be stopped on the street by someone who described himself as a veteran of the Vietnam War with questions about you and other Asian American women.
Yeah, I think that is definitely true because, and this isn't necessarily unique to the U.S. military, the Japanese Imperial Army forced Korean women into sexual servitude. Mm-hmm. This is what people do in times of war. We objectify women and we make them into sex workers. So the fact that we've had so many wars in Asian nations and thus have military bases in Asia, it's not surprising that this stereotype would be reinforced in the late 20th century.
Well, we are out of time, and my thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Jennifer Ho, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And she's president of the Association of Asian American Studies and professor of ethnic studies at the University of Colorado at Boulder. And Mari Uehara, thank you for joining us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you.
And telling us about your grandmother. We will make sure that we give her some due on our Facebook page. And that's Mari Uehara, and she is a freelance journalist. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the show. You can do that wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us.